Hey folks, this is Michael Gallup, and I am the pastor of The Table, a new faith community located in Little Rock, Arkansas. And today we're going to be exploring the second part of our three-part series on the table values. So we're exploring our three core values that shape and inform our approach to life, to ministry, to God. And these three values are wonder, friendship, and restoration. And today we're going to be looking at the second value, friendship. As I just stated, our first and primary value is wonder. And this is the way in which we talk about the worship that we have as a church, which we see as the love exchanged between God and His creation. And the way that that plays out is this sense of revelation, that with wonder, you have both a noun and a verb. You have a thing that is revealed to be surprising, beautiful, to show us something new. And then you have the action, the response to that revelation. And for us, when we encounter the love, the grace of God, the beauty of God, we can't help but be changed. It affects us in tremendous ways. And I think in many ways, then, that we must take that revelation response, that relational piece of wonder, and apply it to our other values. So the question that we have to ask when we want to ask, what are we to be like? What are we to do is, what is God like? What has He done? What is He doing? And while there's quite a bit that could be said about who God is and what God is like, I think one of the most fundamental descriptors of the nature of God is that God is love. As the Apostle John writes in his first epistle, God is love. Obviously, that can mean perhaps a lot of things. You know, love is one of these words that has been devalued a bit because of its overuse. I mean, with the same breath, we can say, I love my wife and I love tacos. Obviously, there's a difference between those two items. The love I have for my wife and the love I have for tacos are not the same thing. Although to see me eat a taco may make you question whether they are or not. But which my point is that love has become sort of, it can mean kind of whatever we want. So what do we mean with this statement, this profound statement about who God is, that God is love? Well, I think the key to understanding this is really locked up in the historical doctrines of our church. Our creeds point to this divine nature being this relationship. We call this the Trinity. That God, although one, is still three. He's one being with three persons. We call these persons the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit or Holy Ghost. And what you see there is at the core of reality. The fundamental truth behind all things is that God is relationship. That He is in a perfect, loving, communal society with Himself. I mean, even the titles of the members of the Trinity have these bear these relational names, Father and Son. One of the early church fathers, Augustine, would talk about the Holy Spirit as being the love shared between the Father and the Son, that their union, their connection, their relationship was so profound, so perfect that it was a person in a sense. Well, there's a lot of implications of that, and that may not be, you know, a perfect representation of who the Holy Spirit is and what's going on in the Trinity. It does speak to the fundamental truth that relationship is core to God's being, who He is. One of the ways that the early church fathers talked about this identity of the Trinity was the divine dance. And so that then asks us the question, what does that say about us? I mean, if we recall, Genesis 1 tells us that we are made in that image. What does it mean that we were made in the image of love, of this divine dance? Well, one insight, I think, comes from the fact that the Hebrew Scriptures actually gives us this plural understanding of God, even in Genesis 1. Now, maybe you know or don't, but the Hebrew people, the Israelites, were just doggedly monotheistic, which is to say that God was singular, period. I mean, their great confession, the Shema, says, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one," or "the Lord alone." And what that did for them was it truly did set them apart from their surrounding cultures, the surrounding peoples, who were very pantheistic, or they had these beliefs that there was a God kind of for everything. So there was a God of, you know, love, and there was a God of war, and there was a God, maybe the sun was God, and this tree was God. And so there was this sense of they didn't really know which way to direct their relationships. They didn't know where to look to discover revelation. And yet the Hebrews had a singular focus on Yahweh. The Lord is one. So despite that, we have this language in Genesis 1, in the creation account. We see this in verse 26. God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness." Now, this is kind of a tremendous thing to read. You would expect him, God, to say, let me, to have a singular voice, and yet he has a plural voice. Now, some scholars would attribute this to kind of the royal nature. This is sort of a royal we, so to speak, a kingly voice that God is using, which I think is a rightful interpretation. And yet we as Christians who hold to the doctrine of Trinity, to the fact that God is love, I don't think are out of line to read into this passage that God is saying, let us, relationship, love, this divine dance, make human beings like us, relational, loving. And I think this has become abundantly clear in the next chapter, as God is surveying his creation, as he's looking down or looking at all that he has made, and he has made several proclamations that this is good, very good. He does have one caveat. There is one thing that he says is not good. And this is before fall. This is before the sin. This is before the serpent. The thing that he says is not good in verse 18 of chapter 2 is, "It is not good that the man should be alone." Crucial, fundamental, pivotal to our identity as human beings, to fulfill our mature purpose, is to be in relationship. Of course, Eve is made from the rib of Adam. Adam beholds her and he says, "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. The one shall be called woman, for out of man this one was taken." And chapter 2 ends with this line, "The man and his wife were both naked and knew no shame." In many ways, this is the pinnacle of the creation account. We immediately after that enter chapter 3 and the serpent enters the scene. And so before we have any sort of a tainting of this pristine, idyllic paradise, the height of that narrative is the two have become one. The Trinity is quite a mystery, and I think folks have struggled to understand it and understandably have used several metaphors to try and pin down what this three but one equation, how does that play out? And often when we do that, we kind of err into a place of heresy. You know, whether it's God is like an egg and you have the shell and the yolk and the white, and that lends itself to one type of heresy, or sometimes God is fatherly and sometimes God is like a son and sometimes he's like a spirit. And again, that takes us away from the idea that these entities, these beings, exist in a community with one another. In many ways, all of our metaphors for understanding the Trinity fall short. And I'm kind of glad. I mean, it's good. I would hope that the very nature of understanding who God is beyond all things, beyond our wildest imaginations, our comprehension. And yet God wrote his nature into you and me, into his creation, into his people. The two become one. And what you see in that loving relationship between the man and his wife is that love expands its boundaries. It is not limited to Adam and Eve. And despite the insurrection of the serpent and their fall through disobedience, the love still expands and they have children. And you see that the singular unit only grows in its inclusion of beings. And in many ways, I think the Trinity is just like that. While we, who are called children of God, are not necessarily in the same level playing field as God, we are invited into the inner workings of the Trinity in Jesus Christ. This is a profound mystery, and yet it is a beautiful mystery. That what God is saving his people to is not simply an escape from fire or escape from pain or, you know, a nice cloud to play our harps on with wings when we die. But he's calling us into a love affair. The perfect, beautiful, all-encompassing love between the Father and the Son becomes ours. And we're invited to dance with the divine. Now that is amazing. And we could spend years, perhaps our whole lifetime, unpacking that idea and that reality. But I want us to kind of take a step back and to look at that and make a statement of value, and I believe a statement of purpose, which is relationships are sacred. And I don't know if I really needed to unpack that any more than all that we've already said about the Trinity and creation, the nature of humanity. But at our core, who we are, to live into our goodness, into our maturity as who we should be, could be, will be, is to love. Which I think is why Jesus so adamantly sums up the entire law with two commandments that he presents as a single commandment. Again, a little bit of a hint or shade at that three but one Trinity equation. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. He also says, with all your mind, which is an addition to what it said in the original Shema, but love the Lord your God with all you got. And the second is like it, he says, love your neighbor as yourself. So we see that all of righteousness, all of life, that the core of who we are, our purpose is to be loved and to love. Relationships are sacred. And John, who gives us that beautiful statement that we began with, that God is love, will show us how that these two commandments, to love God and love neighbor, are intrinsically connected. He says, in various ways, that if you say you love God, and yet do not have love for your brother or sister, you are a liar. Now these are harsh words, but this is a harsh reality, that to love God requires us to love one another, which speaks to the reality that we are connected, related to God. We are in on the divine dance. So to hate our brother or sister is in some way to hate the very nature of God. The two cannot nor should be separated. So what does that mean for us? If relationships are sacred, if God is love, if the great commandment is all summed up in love, what does that say for who we are, for how we should live in this world? Well, I think that it has to say something to one of the greatest problems that we're dealing with in our current age, which is isolation. it may sound odd to say that folks are more isolated than ever when we have a certain level of technology that allows us to connect in a greater sense than ever before. Obviously, to talk about friendship or connection would draw one's imagination to social media. The basis of our biggest social media platform, Facebook, is friends. We connect and we have these digital platforms to speak to one another, to listen from one to one another, opportunity for relationship. And yet, there is a great sense of isolation even in the midst of all of this digital connection. The effects of loneliness are just catastrophic. A recent study, which was highlighted in an article in The Guardian, pointed to the fact that young people, particularly millennials, have reported higher levels of loneliness, and that in conjunction with this loneliness was poor health. That there was, in many ways, at least a correlation, if not a direct causation, of early death to loneliness. The study shows that people who talk about themselves or describe themselves as lonely are 50% more likely to die before their time. And the research also suggests that loneliness is as dangerous to our health as smoking 15 cigarettes a day and is more hazardous than being obese. It's not good for man to be alone. And yet our culture is beginning to shape itself to cater to our isolation and loneliness. I mean, think about how the newest neighborhood around you has been built compared to some of the older ones. So I live in a community in Little Rock called Stiff Station. And this neighborhood has its, kind of could date it back to around the turn of the centuries, the 1900s. I believe the house we live in was built around 1920. And every house on my block has a front porch. And we have sidewalks on both sides of the street. I mean, these places were built for kind of community. It was built for people to walk and to run into each other, to develop relationships via the front porch and the sidewalk. I mean, in fact, yesterday, I was sitting out on my front porch. It was a beautiful spring day, and one of my neighbors were walking down, and my children ran out to them, and as they are so prone to do, were very bold to enter into a relationship. And I think my daughter, Mary Grace, goes, "You want to see a cool trick?" And she showed them how she could cross her eyes, and my other son did a somersault, and they were really great and engaged with us, and my wife and I went out and talked with them, and I mean, really, I think we made new friends. And we would have never met or encountered these people without utilizing our front porch and them utilizing the sidewalk. Yet, in most of the newer communities, often located in our suburbs, sidewalks are non-existent. The front of our house are usually garages in which we zip into and immediately the door closes automatically behind us. We're ushered into our well-fortified sanctuary. Our communities have gone away from being designed around walking to driving, and in so doing has continued to further isolate us from one another. How many of you out there know the names, let alone the stories or what's going on in the lives of your immediate neighbors? I was asked that question several years ago, and I found it to be a damning answer. I simply just didn't know. I think I knew the name of one neighbor, and I sure as heck didn't know any of the stories. And that became in us a call to change how we interacted. We began to realize that there was a great need right next door for connection. So we would make ourselves known, and we would do the best that we could to know our neighbors. Which is a way of saying to love our neighbors. Knowledge is in no way separate from love. In fact, the Hebrews, when they would talk about a couple becoming one, when they had sex, the terminology that they would use would be they knew each other. And that wasn't just a way of kind of being, you know, puritanical and prudish. We don't want to talk about sex. So we're going to use this term, and we all wink, wink, knows what it means. This was an intentional metaphor for what happened that intimacy, that union of marriage, that like Adam and Eve, the couple becomes naked and yet knows no shame. They know one another. They see one another as they are, not hidden, not holding back, but fully exposed, warts and all. And they say, I choose you. I love you. Even though, or because, I know you. Knowledge of the other is core to intimacy. So, if this is a problem, this loneliness, this lack of connection, and if relationships are sacred, then what do we do? How do we bridge that gap? How do we live out the great commandment to love God by loving our neighbors as ourselves? Well, I think, again, calling us back to our first value of wonder, we looked to the revelation of God. What has He revealed? What wonders has He shown us about His love? Again, in that great epistle, John says, we love because He first loved us. I see this really as sort of a process. Our ability to love, our connection to others is in many ways a direct source, a response to God's love for us. And so to ask how we love one another, we need to first ask, how has God loved us? Again, there's a ton of ways to address this, ton of scriptures that we could point to that speak to the love that God has for His people. But I want us to focus in on a series of escalating metaphors, a kind of a hierarchy almost of how God relates to His people, metaphors that He has given us. And I got this from a counselor taught me at Denver Seminary. His name's Hud McWilliams. Tremendous teacher. If you ever get a chance to come across any of his stuff, I would highly recommend it. But Hud says we begin at kind of the beginning. We begin at the beginning. of course, right? Yeah, in the beginning. But we begin with this kind of lowest rung on the ladder, this lowest level of intimacy, with the metaphor of the potter and clay. And we're told in Jeremiah and other places that God is like a potter and He's shaping us in His hands. And obviously there's some great intimacy there, this idea of being molded or held by His hands, that He's giving us form and life. He's writing His beauty into us as an artist. And yet, obviously, we're an inanimate object. We're completely pliable to the whims and will of God. It's not much of a relationship as we often think. So we take another step up this intimacy ladder. We come to the metaphor of the shepherd and the sheep. Again, this is a beautiful metaphor. It's highlighted most clearly and perhaps most beautifully in Psalm 23. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Just the imagery of being led by still waters, to be shepherded or to be pastured in green fields, to be protected in the face of death. Just tremendous what's happening here. And yet, while this is better, we're now at least a living creature. We're a sheep, you know, and we don't have much autonomy or agency. We don't have much intellect. We don't have a lot of capacity to reciprocate love. And so we keep going up the intimacy ladder. The next metaphor that we see is a master and a servant. At least now we're human, you know. We've moved from being dirt and a sheep to now we're human. And again, there's beauty in this connection, this relationship. God as our master, our Lord, is provides protection, provides guidance, provides inclusion in His household. And yet there still is that gulf of intimacy where, while we're human, the lack of agency is still there. You know, we're kind of a servant or a slave even. And so we continue up that relational metaphor ladder, and we come to a father and a child. Here we have a greater sense of agency. We belong. We are part of the family. And obviously there's so much beauty. This has been one of the more healing metaphors for my faith journey is to understand God as my Father, this lover, this mentor, this guide that who's also, you know, intimately close to me and near to me. And yet, this still is not a fully mature relationship. Between a father and a child, there's still a hierarchy there. There is one is clearly above the other. The child still lacks kind of this fullness of being, this fullness of maturation. And so we come to the penultimate metaphor, and that is a friend. Now, it's a single thing. It's not a father and a child or, you know, this and that. It is simply a friend. And of course, we get this in John 15. The night that Jesus is betrayed, he speaks to his disciples and he goes, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends. If you do what I command you, I do not call you servants any longer, because a servant does not know what the master is doing. But I have called you friends, because I have made known to you everything that I've heard from my Father. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask him in my name. I am giving you these commands so that you may love one another." Just a tremendously revolutionary passage. Jesus looks to his disciples, who would much more resonate relationally as servants. Jesus says, I don't call you servant any longer. The disciple would follow around their master, would learn from him, but they would also kind of care for his needs. They would, you know, procure lodging or food, and we see this happening in the scriptures where he kind of sends the disciples to go, you know, do something for him, whether it's they go get the donkey for the triumphal entry, or they go get a room for the Passover meal, or they go get food, or they're told to go get food when he feeds the 5,000. And so they're serving the Lord here. They're serving their master. And yet here we come to this end, and Jesus says, "You're my friends." And what's fascinating about that is this is a statement he's making not because they have necessarily earned that designation. It wasn't like they were just this amazing, relationally, you know, highly apt group of folks who just, you know, they love Jesus so well. He's like, "You know, I like you guys. You're my friends." Jesus is the one who is offering friendship. And he tells them, "Love like I love. This is my command I give you. Love like I love." As we saw in another way, John says, we love because he first loved us. We see that our ability to love is based in the loving example of Christ. What does Jesus do? He sacrifices everything because he loves these guys, these friends. Now, Hud and I agree with this, as there's another rung on this relational ladder, and that is lover. We're told that the church is the bridegroom, and that is the bride, and that Jesus is the bridegroom, and that the culmination of history, of the world, of creation, is this great marriage between the bride and the bridegroom, and that the imagery we're given of the new heavens and the new earth is of this great banquet, this party celebrating our marital union. This image is given to us in the Old Testament, and I think there's tremendous mystery to be plumbed meditating upon our union, our relationship with God as lover. But for our sake today, and for, I think, the needs of our community, the call to friendship, to befriending the other, is in many ways our call to mission. As I talked about just a while ago, that at the heart of so much struggle and heartache and problem in our world today is loneliness and isolation. This is, of course, biblical. We talked about the intimacy that Adam and Eve shared, that they were naked and knew no shame, that they knew each other wholly and fully, and lacked any sense of discomfort or unease in the presence of one another. And immediately after they eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they hide. They hide from one another, and they hide from God. They cover up their nakedness, and they know shame. God responds to this with an invitation back into relationship and says, "Where have you gone?" And that question simply says, "I expected you to be here with me, together, and you're not. Come back." And we see this isolation, this hiding, played out into the major metaphor of the Old Testament, the major issue and problem of the Old Testament, exile. That they didn't belong. That they were outside of their rightful place. The rightful place of relationship. And so God speaks into the midst of this hiding. In the midst of this shame. This place where we hide our nakedness. We don't want to expose the truth of who we are to one another. And especially to God. For fear of judgment. For fear of ridicule. Whatever it may be. God speaks this promise to that shame. He says, "I will be your God, and you will be my people." And we see here in the passage we just read from John, the fulfillment of that promise. Jesus looks at his disciples and said, "I call you friends. You who are far off, who are hiding, who are in exile, I've brought you so close. We stand shoulder to shoulder, and I will lay down my life for you like a friend should." So what we see here in many ways is a call to befriend the other. A call to love, as Jesus says, like he loved. Before he goes off, before he ascends to the right hand of the Father after the resurrection, he of course gives the great commission to his disciples. He says, "Go and make disciples." To follow his lead, to do what he has done. And we have interpreted that to mean a lot of things, but at the heart, this is the purpose of the church, is to make disciples. Of course, we make them like Jesus made them, and we see here that to be a disciple of Jesus is to be his friend. I don't think it's any sort of a stretch to say that the great commission to us, the purpose of the church, is to make friends. Of course, we have to define what it means to be a friend. As we talked about with love at the beginning of this podcast, we see that friendship has kind of lost some of its meaning. You know, as I said a little while ago, the leading ways in which we engage on the internet is through the social media platform, of course, Facebook, with our friends. We have a friend list. And I went to check prior to teaching on this, and this is not a brag. In fact, I'm kind of actually ashamed of this number, but I had in excess of 1,100 friends. And that's just ludicrous. I don't know some of these people. I mean, literally, I went through this list and I don't know who that is, where I connected with them, how we became friends. There's people in there that I simply follow. There's brands that I like. There's people that I met one time and we connected on Facebook and we've never talked to each other ever again. And yet I call them my friends. And in so doing, I've really devalued what friendship is or could be. Now, we could go and spend a significant amount of time talking about the ills of social media. And I don't want to just purely demonize it. I think that social media has its place within the framework of friendship. Can be a way to aid our connection. The problem is when it becomes a replacement for real relationship, for friendship. Our worship pastor Cliff, during our discussion on this, said that oftentimes Facebook gives him a false sense of connection. That because he is quote unquote friends with someone online and sees their posts and he feels connected, like he knows this person, he knows what they're doing, and yet he spends no time with them in real life. And so while he feels like he's connected, he's actually not. And what that does is it creates this hurdle for him. It creates this barrier, this gap of isolation. Instead of truly being connected, we've kind of sold our souls, and I say that hyperbolically, we've sold our souls for this really insufficient alternative. We have to move beyond relationships that are just about liking one another's posts and spend time with each other bodily in each other's presence. Presence and body presence is crucial for connection. Another way of helping us to define friendship is continuing to say what it is not. With what we just said about social media, we're saying that friendship is not digital. It is not merely liking. I would add that friendship is not self-serving purely. So what I'm trying to say there is oftentimes we approach a relationship as a transaction. And we use the other person. They serve our needs, and we will keep score. So I think the most innocuous example I can kind of give of this is you go on a lunch meeting with a friend from work, and you pay for their meal. In your mind, you make a score that says they owe me, or I should get a favor from them. At the very least, they should pay for my meal one time down the line. You do it not as an act of kindness, but as an opportunity to achieve some sort of an end. And at its worst, these transactional, self-serving relationships, they see the others as just resources to be used. Now, again, I think that there is an aspect or a place for these types of relationships. Common courtesy in the workplace where you're kind to one another. But really, this is the opposite of love. Jesus tells us that love and friendship is based in sacrifice. And yet, often we only befriend people for what we can get out of them. And what happens then is, when we have friends that are friends with us transactionally, they fall away in times of need. They fall away when being our friend isn't easy or beneficial to them. And we can find ourselves extremely isolated if all the relationships around us are purely transactional. I mentioned Cliff just a moment ago, but Cliff is in many ways one of my, if not my best friend. We've known each other for over a decade now. And while there's probably been some times where our relationship wasn't as deep or as intimate as it had been or could be, I always knew that Cliff would be there for me if I needed him, and vice versa. I think the clearest example of that was when my brother died. It was a few years back, and I was living in Denver, Colorado, and I was flying out to South Carolina, where his body was and where my father was, to do the funeral. And I stopped over in Little Rock, and my mom came and met me and got on the plane with me, and we finished our flight. But while I was sitting in Little Rock, I had some time to kill, and Cliff and his wife Jillian took some time off of work and just came down to the airport and sat with me. And they listened to me express whatever I could about what was happening, but mainly I just cried. And I know that this was not an easy thing for Cliff and Jillian to do. They took time out of their day. They took time to kind of eat and take care of themselves on their lunch break. It was not easy or comfortable to sit with a grown man who's crying in a public place. You never know what to say in those situations. It's really awkward sometimes. But him being there was the most comforting thing I could imagine. I just knew, it's hard to even put words on it, but I just knew it was okay because he was there. To me, that is the opposite of transactional friendship. That this isn't a sacrifice on the scale of Jesus dying for us, but it is a sacrifice. And I think if you ask Cliff, or if you ask anyone in that sort of situation, there's a blessing in sacrificing for another. that while it was awkward and they cost them a lot, probably had a sense of real connection. And honestly, that's what our hearts are longing for. Not for more success, not for, you know, greater things to put on our resume, or for more comfort, or whatever it is that we often, you know, devote ourselves to in our lives. We long to connect, to be known, and to know. And the reality is, to do so in this world, it's risky. It's vulnerable. We have to expose ourselves. And that's a shameful thing to do. Or it can feel shameful, I should say. And yet, when we do, when we find a person like Cliff, or like Jesus, who sees us in that place where we're ugly crying, or we're full of whatever, and we just let it all out, and we're accepted and loved, we get a taste of that place in paradise, where the two were naked and knew no shame. I belonged because I was loved, because I was a friend. That's what Jesus does for us. He says, I choose you. You didn't choose me. And I think this has far less to do with, you know, whether you're a Calvinist or not. I think this is mainly just a statement of relationship, friendship, because I want to be your friend. And I'll do whatever it takes. And I know you. I know you better than you know yourself, and I still say yes. I choose you. I see all of you naked and exposed, and you have nothing to be ashamed of, because I love you. Of course, Jesus would die on the cross naked, exposed, entering into the place of our shame with us, so we could enter into the place of friendship with him. And as I said, that's our purpose. That's our call as a church. The Great Commission for us is to make friends. Friendship is a difficult thing. As I said just a little while ago, it's risky, it's vulnerable. But if you've ever had a really good friend, if you've ever had that sort of experience, you know that it is worth dying for. And when you read Jesus say this, while it's this amazing sacrifice, you kind of get it. You're like, yeah, I'd die for that person too. And that's a rare thing to find in this world. But here's what's amazing. All of us can and have found that in Jesus. And what that allows us to do is to go out and allow people to find it in us. One of my closest friends in seminary was a man named Andrew. We worked together, we studied together, we had a lot in common, but it had entered this place not just of mere companionship or transaction. We entered into this place of true friendship. And in fact, when he moved to Portland, I drove out there with him, and we made this great kind of expedition out of it, where we went to Yellowstone, and we went to the Grand Tetons, and Lake Coeur d'Alene in Idaho, and we spent a couple days in Portland exploring the wilderness there, the Columbia River Valley Gorge, and it was just this amazing kind of experience, and we hugged, and I got on the plane and flew back to Denver, and I was really beat up, because this person I'd shared so much of my life with had challenged me, had grown me had, you know, given himself to me in such ways that it allowed me to mature and grow as a man. I was just mourning the loss of that friendship. You know, we're still friends, but that distance, just, you know, the availability, the presence that's shared, and when you're in proximity with another, was gone. And as I prayed to God, I was just asking that he would send into my life another person like that. That did, in essence, another Andrew, someone who would love me and be a friend to me like he had been to me prior. And God's answer was, you go be an Andrew to someone else. We're sitting here waiting for someone to befriend us. And the answer is to go befriend another. The amount of people that don't know that sort of relationship, don't know that sort of love, and are dying. You know, we heard the stats. They're dying of loneliness, literally. And the sacrifice could be as simple as knocking on a door and doing that awkward thing of saying, hey, I'm your neighbor. Sorry, I've never really introduced myself, but I just thought since we're neighbors, we should know each other. Here, I brought you some cookies. This is my name. This is who I am. If you ever want to hang out, maybe we could. I admit, that could be a pretty big sacrifice. But there's no greater love. And again, we don't do this because we quote-unquote have to, because it's our duty. It's our great commission. We do this because we have been loved, chosen, befriended. Jesus sees all of us and says, yes, I choose you. And if you have experienced that love, that level of friendship, oh, you know it's good. You know it's good. And you know it's what you were made for. Can we invite others into that divine dance, the divine friendship, to love God and love one another?